What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The evidence prosecutors laid out over 5 days tracks the timeline from the first online messages when Celeste was 11 to the inflatable pool in the garage. And the body in the Tesla. The judge heard it all and ruled the people met their burden on every count. And David now faces a trial with special circumstances that put the death penalty on the table. Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, is with us to help us break it down. Robin has the day off. Prosecutors mapped a 21-minute window. Celeste's Uber arrived at 10:10 p.m. Her phone went permanently silent short after. The next morning, Burke sat for her radio interview about his album, then allegedly started ordering chainsaws, a body bag, and a burn cage under a fake name. Does that timeline alone get the prosecution to premeditation, or do they need the financial motive in this as well to help seal it here?
Few things. I think that timeline certainly gets them to like abuse of a corpse or covering up a murder or something like that. But when it comes to premeditation for the killing of Celeste, that's a little more debatable, I think. And you know, certainly there are some precursors, but I think that motive is going to loom large once the trial comes, because it makes sense, right? Like if a person is about to be is on the rise and is already a star, might be a mega star at some point. And then, oh my gosh, your underage lover is threatening to ruin your career. And then shortly thereafter, that lover disappears. Certainly, common sense can put together those dots. And that's what the prosecution will be asking the jury to do.
Blair Burke pressed Detective Farrell on Celeste's messages, threats to strangle Burke, to destroy his career, references to harming herself. She also got the medical examiner to say he couldn't definitively rule out that the wounds occurred post-mortem. I mean, is there a self-inflicted death defense here? They were insinuating that could possibly be part of this as well, or is Burke just building a record that she can point to during trial to manufacture reasonable doubt? At the end of the day, that's what they're going for, reasonable doubt. Is there a way that they can get there, that Celeste did this all to herself, and then David reacted in a horrible way to cover up the relationship and the corpse?
Absolutely. I think the defense is going to go down that route. They're going to say, and they've made statements to the press consistent with this, saying, hey, David did not cause the death and is not guilty of murder. They're going to go in there, I think, and say that this was a very tumultuous situation. It was kind of rapidly escalating. You have this underage romantic partner's criminal victim under those circumstances, and she's threatening to out him, and things just got chaotic and crazy, and she caused the injuries to herself and died. And then David is left with this dead minor's body in his vicinity, and he's saying, what do I do about this? Well, if I call the police. They're going to say, they're going to think I did it. I can't have that. So what's the next course of action? Trying to get rid of the evidence and doing that in a cover up fashion and covering up interfering with a dead body is one charge, but causing the death of another person is a much more serious charge. I think that's the route they're going to take at trial.
Do you think that is where this eventually ends up once this trial actually does get underway, however many years it is down the road, that David is going to basically be admitting to several of the charges, the disposal of the body, the cover up end of this, but not the actual murder itself? If they go down that road, I mean, there's certainly penalties to that. It's not the death penalty. It might not be life in prison. It's certainly going to be some time. It's not just, oh, you overreacted and you didn't go to police to get help. You did all this. Is that going to be the goal? I mean, is that the goal, do you think, at this point when they're with the attorneys for David, of obviously keep him alive? But is it more so damage control than it is you're going to, walk out of here and, drop a new album?
It is not uncommon, Tony, at all at trial when there is significant evidence against the defendant for defense counsel to pursue like a compromise verdict, to go to the jury and be like, hey, look, we're going to be real with you. There's enough evidence on the, cover up the abuse of a corpse charge. Find him guilty of that. But there is not enough evidence that he caused this death. And in fact, he didn't. And you cannot convict him of that. But if that were to occur, one, that abuse of a corpse charge is a felony. It certainly carries prison time, significant prison time. And then on top of that, they have the essay on a child charge. And that charge, even though it's not murder, that can carry decades. And so you got to be careful if you're asking for a compromise verdict that you don't ask for too big of a compromise and get dinged on both of those serious charges, in which case he would be looking at decades in prison, even if he beats the murder charge.
Yeah, I mean, there really isn't a gray path here. I mean, do you go in of just, this is all a lie? This is all, I mean, the evidence is damning. I mean, at the very least for the relationship that was going on there. I mean, on the surface it is. I mean, we don't necessarily have, well, actually we do. I forgot. There are the images on his phone. So that's there. So it's damning. It's damning anyway you play this. But juries sometimes when the evidence is somewhat questionable, and if there isn't a litany of other charges that are going to lock the person away for a very long time, sometimes go to the lesser charges, where if the litany of other charges wasn't there, they might just convict on the higher charge, but they'll feel more confident in doing all this. He's gonna serve his time, is kind of the thought process, to not go for the murder one. It's obviously probably a strategy that I'm going to guess the defense of David is taking into account here. Do you think that's the route that everything goes down, and the bet that they're going to try and take with that jury?
I think that's certainly on the table. And I think that, when you're conducting a jury trial, especially as defense counsel, they already kind of see you as a person about whom they should be cautious, because, is this guy lying to me? Are they fabricating some sideshow that's going to try to distract me? And so you got to be real with these jurors. And sometimes that means making concessions. Sometimes that means acknowledging the weight of the evidence for certain charges. And I think in this case, that might make sense because, it'd be a perilous route to go to this jury as defense counsel and say, all these charges are bogus. They don't have any evidence. Why are we even here? We shouldn't even be talking about this. I think you really have to be a little bit more solemn and appreciate the gravity of what some of the apparently undisputable facts could show.
Yeah, I saw some comments. She fell on the knife. Yes, it's the Ellen Greenberg case all over again. But let's talk about it. I mean, just the fact, like the Ellen Greenberg case, the idea that somebody did this to themselves, over there, that never made it to trial, never made it to a criminal complaint. In this case, obviously, we're there. But the idea that someone
would have done this to themselves. I mean, people don't typically do this. People don't typically stab themselves. And from what we understand, that was lookingly what to be the cause of death was of Celeste Rivas Hernandez, was the stab wounds. That's a hard sell too. I mean, is that what you go with, that she did this to herself? Yes, jury, it's rare, but it happens. And these were, you know, very hyped up young people and very emotional. And then she, in a dramatic fashion, took the knife or whatever the hell it was and just started stabbing herself. I mean, can you sell that to a jury? Is that really, really a hard one to try and get them to digest?
Well, I think it's very difficult. That we would have to look at a few things, whether there would be a witness who could testify to that. And, you know, the only two of whom I'm aware are David and Celeste, and Celeste is gone. So does that mean that David would get up there and sort of tell this version of events where Celeste turned this sharp blade on her own 14-year-old body and killed herself? You know, that's going to be met with a lot of suspicion, I think. And then on top of that, my understanding from the autopsy is that there were at least two sharp force wounds that they believe caused Celeste's demise. So she would have had to stab herself multiple times, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think one of them was in the lung that was determined to be the most terminal or something. But a person stabbing themselves multiple times, on the other hand, a 14-year-old doesn't always have access to a gun. They might not have access to other means by which, you know, cyanide pills or something. They might not have access to that stuff. So they might just reach for what they have around them, and that would be a knife.
The three chainsaws is quite a dramatic piece of this story. Three chainsaws recovered from the home. Everyone tested negative for blood, and LAPD never collected them for further testing, which, again, the PI found them and the burn cage that they left at the house. How many inroads did the investigation leave for the defense to try and go down the reasonable doubt category of, well, these are just props for music videos. There's no blood on any of this stuff. You know, he's macabre. You know, he's this, you know, he's that. I mean, I don't understand why they left these chainsaws in the burn cage in the house of the guy they suspected of chopping up a young woman. That seems to be like a no-brainer of like, hey, what evidence do we take? Well, the chainsaws are at the top of the list. The burn cage is number two, but apparently they weren't even on the list. What do you make of that?
Frankly, it's baffling. Baffling why law enforcement would not seize those items that appear central, including based on the information they had at the time. At the time, they had a disarticulated minor girl's body inside of a vehicle, and they're searching the house of the person in possession of that vehicle. And you find these instruments by which that disarticulation could occur. I can't fathom why you wouldn't seize those, even if they were tested for blood and tested negative. You know, blood can be removed from an item, but that doesn't mean there wasn't other biological material that could have been at least explored and tried to have been tested for. And so I just don't get why they left those. And certainly the jury's not going to get it either. And then when the defense says, hey, that's, you know, one of 10 errors law enforcement made, on top of the fact that you don't have any witnesses who did this, you don't have the murder weapon, you don't have a significant amount, you start to create some opportunities for a defense there.
How strong is the claim that David has of, she told me she was 18. Now everybody's telling me she's 13. I mean, the police did come to his house one day and say, by the way, she's a runaway and she's 13. Is there any, I mean, but there's the notarized affidavit, the you can go travel the world from the parents if she's 18. There's no notarized affidavit. There's no need for a notarized affidavit to allow her to go and travel. But was that something, if that was done behind the scenes and David, let's say, is not aware of how his travel is being coordinated, let's say there's a group of people behind the scenes that are doing that, which in this case there probably is. There's probably handlers that are handling all of that. So somebody would have seen the age of her. Is there any world in which David can argue that he was bamboozled, that she said she was 18 this whole time? Maybe he can even argue that the family played along too. I don't know. But do you see any route where they try to make that argument in court, or was that just a stupid argument that he made when the police came knocking one day?
You know, of course, it's not perfectly analogous, but it reminds me of a situation where let's say that there's a liquor store and somebody comes in, and this person is about 4.5 feet tall, and they have, you know, a Power Rangers shirt on, and they don't have an ID, and they have, you know, they're carrying with them like a toy that they brought with them. And you have all of this indicia of this person being underage. And then when the person tries to buy alcohol, they say, "Oh no, I'm 21. I don't think that liquor store owner could use that as a defense by saying, "Well, they told me they were 21. Now, of course, you got to show ID. It's not perfectly analogous, but you see what I'm saying, where you can't just be blind. You can't blind yourself to these obvious facts right in front of your face and then claim you didn't have knowledge of those facts. You did. And knowledge of those facts could lead to a reasonable inference of knowledge that this person was underage. I think that there are similar indicia here when the police are telling you this person's a runaway. Hey, people who are over 18 aren't runaways. That would never happen. Yeah. And so, you know, all of that just doesn't make sense. I don't think that that's going to be a credible position to take.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you can go with there's too many hands in the pot here, and one hand's not talking to the other, and you don't know, and you're just I think it's a stretch. There's a lot of stretches that need to be believed in order for David to be completely unwitting in all of this and just be there one day and, "Oh my God, she stabbed herself. What do I do now?" I mean, I don't know. At the end of the day, it's damning no matter what. Prosecutors are running the murder for financial gain special circumstance play here on this. Burke's former financial manager testified about transferring Texas properties to his mother to shield assets. I think a lot of people wonder about just how shielded that actually is when you do something, when you're moving assets and the motivation behind the moving of those assets. Does the motivation of moving those assets ever play any sort of role when it comes to seizing those sort of assets? Or is this just how it works? If you get it moved quick enough before the law comes calling, you're in the clear. Is there any mechanism that can be looked at here of, okay, he had these assets. The law started looking at him for this. Turns out he did this. If he did, again, he's guilty till, or innocent till proven guilty. But if proven he did, and the family's moving these assets around to protect them from civil liability, whatever it may be, can you ever go back and get those things? Or once they're moved to another name that's not the defendant, are they safe?
Yeah, so I was recently looking at Colorado's version of this law, and most states have it, where you can essentially petition a court to freeze assets to ensure that they are not transferred, ensure that they're not liquidated, and things like that. Because and the court, in making that determination, looks into the motivation for the attempts to move assets. You know, for example, if a person was moving assets in anticipation of litigation because they were trying to deprive a claimant of access to those assets, typically, that's a no-go. You can't do that. And the court will take measures to freeze and or seize those assets. Now, if you have already transferred them before there's any petition to the court, that makes it a little bit more difficult. And there are further analyses in which the court must engage to then say, "Hey, could we go to this defendant's father, who now has, you know, this valuable whatever piece of jewelry, and say, hey, that you can't do anything with that. That's got to seize that." That part's a little more questionable. So it depends on when the assets were transferred, when a court was made aware that there could be some funny stuff in terms of asset transfer to deprive a claimant, and also California law and how it handles those things. Although I suspect it's the same as Colorado law.
Yeah. I mean, it's money, but obviously at the end of the day, a life is gone, so that's far more important. But you do wonder, and you want justice, and you don't want people skirting it for their own gain out of horrendous behavior. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversations right there. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage of this case as we continue to follow it.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Well, I hate to say it, but we've been saying this all along. Celeste Rivas Hernandez's parents allegedly signed a notarized travel consent form allowing their daughter to fly to London for a week with a grown man. No other family member on the trip, no adult sister, not an uncle, not a cousin, just a girl who hadn't started high school and a platinum-selling musician 5 years older than her on a private trip. The form did sign itself. Somebody walked into an office, put her name on a legal document, and sent their kid across the ocean alone with David Anthony Burke, allegedly. And that's our starting point today, because everything that follows makes it worse. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. If you want to take our podcast with you wherever you go, there's the QR code on the screen. If you're watching us on YouTube right now, that'll take you to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening, and you can hit subscribe and take us with you there. So I'll leave that up for a few minutes, and you can check that out. So we've been saying for a long time, Celeste Rivas Hernandez was failed by basically every adult in her life, and that turns out to be quite true. Celeste's father would later tell reporters through his attorney that he'd never had any contact with Burke. We'll come back to that. We'll revisit that little factoid, okay? It's such an angering case. And here's the other thing the parents already knew by the time they signed that form. Deputies had been to Burke's door about Celeste in February 24, told them face-to-face that their daughter was a 13-year-old runaway. Law enforcement drew the line in ink, and the parents, they signed the permission slip anyway. July 27th marked the fifth and final day of Burke's preliminary hearing in Los Angeles. Judge Charlene Olmedo ruled that prosecutors met their burden on all counts. Burke, the singer who goes by David D4VD, was held to answer for first-degree murder with special circumstances, including lying in wait, financial gain, and killing a witness. He was also held on charges related to continuous illegal conduct with Celeste, who was under 14, and unlawful mutilation of her remains. No bail. Arraignment August 31st. The DA's office says he's eligible for the death penalty, and they haven't decided whether to pursue it. The DA, Nathan Hochman, told reporters that what they'd presented over those 5 days was, in his words, a small but illustrative fraction of the evidence they have. A small but illustrative fraction. But the ruling isn't what landed hardest on day five. What landed hardest was the testimony about Celeste's family and how catastrophically they failed their daughter. LAPD Detective Corey Farrell, under cross-examination by defense attorney Blair Burke, testified that the parents of both Burke and Celeste knew about the relationship. Burke's argument to the court was blunt. The family had multiple opportunities to intervene and didn't. The relationship, Burke said, was no secret. Obviously, it doesn't justify anything that David did. It just puts people that want to be viewed in one category over here as grieving parents. Oh my gosh, how could this possibly have happened to our little girl? Well, you should have given a shit about her while she was alive and not let her go around the world with an adult that clearly isn't having slumber parties, watching reruns of Nancy Drew and eating cookies at night. I have a daughter this exact same age, and there is no planet, there is no human being on this world who will ever come into my home. I don't care how friendly they are, how close she thinks she is to somebody. that will ever be like, oh yeah, let's go take a trip around the world together. You and this other young adult. Let me sign that paper so that can happen. That seems like a great idea. No. 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 She was a runaway. Bullshit. You were a runaway from parenting. You ran away from that job. Why was she running away from you? Why was she finding so much comfort and peace over with David outside of your own home? That's a question I'd love to have answered. Because the evidence is starting to stack up, and it's looking pretty shitty, in my opinion. Celeste's own sister traveled with them to one of Burke's shows in Las Vegas. Text messages indicated the group planned to stay together at a hotel. Celeste was filmed sitting with Burke's family in a VIP section at a concert at the Fonda Theater in Hollywood. Burke attended church with family members of Celeste's family on at least one occasion. He picked Celeste up from her aunt's home in Los Angeles. On top of all that, the London consent form notarized, signed by her parents, authorizing a trip overseas with no family chaperone for an entire week, allegedly. The detective acknowledged that investigators had recovered messages referencing some of those plans, but couldn't confirm that every single planned activity actually occurred. That's a fair caveat for a Las Vegas hotel reservation or a church visit. It doesn't apply to a notarized legal document. A permission slip isn't a plan, it's a decision. On February 17th of 24, the Riverside County Sheriff's Office contacted Burke after identifying his phone number and Celeste's phone records. She'd been reported missing from her family's phone in Lake Elsinore. Burke told deputies he'd last spoken to her a few days earlier, but claimed he didn't know she was a minor. He told them she'd said she was 18. Body camera footage played during the hearing captured him saying it out loud. She told me she was 18. Everybody's telling me she was 13. When Los Angeles County deputies arrived at his West Hollywood home that same day, they told him directly, Celeste Rivas was 13 years old. She's a runaway. They did a welfare check, didn't find her at the residence, and left. One deputy told Burke on camera, I hope they find her. And that was it. They walked away satisfied with the cooperation. Doing a deep dive there into making sure that they're protecting and serving. That date, February 17th of 24, is the last, is the line that can't be uncrossed. Before that date, some are going to try and argue, maybe the parents didn't fully understand the scope of what was happening. Maybe they thought Burke was a friend. Maybe they didn't ask enough questions. No, after that date, nobody gets to claim ignorance. Law enforcement told Burke to his face how old their daughter was, and every piece of family facilitated contact that came after the London trip, the continued weekends at his Hollywood Hills house, the Texas visit to meet his family. All of it happened on the other side of that line. So let's go back to what Celeste's father said. In May of 26, after Burke's arrest, Jesus Rivas released a statement through attorney Patrick Steinfeld. The quote given to multiple outlets, including Rolling Stone and TMZ, was categorical. I never had any contact with this guy, and we haven't received any money from him or anyone in his family. It's a lot of questions to answer that you weren't asked. Not, I barely knew him. Not, we met briefly. Never had any contact. Well, you, sir, allegedly have signed a notarized permission slip to send your daughter to London with him. Your other daughter traveled with them to Las Vegas. He was attending church with your family. He was picking your daughter up from her aunt's house. He was sitting in VIP sections with your relatives at his own concerts. And you never had any contact with the guy? Those are the allegations. That's the evidence they say they have. One of those things can't be true. Either the main denial doesn't hold up or the court evidence is fabricated. Nobody at the hearing argued the evidence was fabricated. Now, prosecutors did present evidence that Celeste's parents took some steps. They took her phone away after one of her runaway incidents. Maybe we should take her phone away after we've allowed her to go traveling with an adult. They called police when she disappeared. They reported her missing. Those aren't the actions of people who don't care at all. Those are gestures that suggest they understood something was wrong and probably didn't want to look accountable. But here's the problem with gestures. After the parents took Celeste's phone, Burke allegedly paid a junior high student in Celeste's class $1,000 to deliver her a replacement phone that he'd purchased. $1,000 to a kid in a middle school so he could keep talking to their daughter. And the relationship didn't just continue, it escalated. Celeste spent weekends at Burke's house in the Hollywood Hills. She traveled with him across the country. She went overseas. All of this after deputies had already told everyone involved exactly how old she was. The parents' interventions were gestures. The permission slip was a decision. I think there are only two explanations that make any sense, and neither one of them is acceptable here. The first is that they saw dollar signs. I don't know. Could be conjecture here. Interscope Records senior vice president testified during the hearing that Burke's contract was worth a minimum of $13 million with an estimated value of up to $19 million. That's not a small-time SoundCloud kid. That's a platinum-selling artist with a deal worth more money than most people will see in a lifetime. A family in Lake Elsinore, a town 2 hours southeast of L.A., with a daughter who had access to VIP sections, international travel, hotel suites, and the inner circle of a major label recording artist. You don't have to be cynical to connect those dots. You just have to look at the permission slip and the Vegas trips and the concert footage and the church visits and ask yourself exactly what was driving those decisions. The second possibility is simpler and arguably worse. They knew something was wrong. They took the phone. They called the police. Then they signed the form anyway. Not because of money or fame or success, because they just didn't care enough to hold the line. I don't want an argument. Let's let our 13-year-old daughter go travel with the adult superstar. And, you know, whatever happens, happens. Pick one. Both are indefensible and neither changes what happened to Celeste. What reporters asked D.A. Hochman about the family's claims that they didn't approve of the relationship, despite the text, the travel documents, the Las Vegas trip, the London form, he sidesteps the question completely, called it an unspeakable tragedy. Wouldn't touch it. That's the elected district attorney of the largest county in the country choosing not to answer a direct question about a 14-year-old parent's. That silence tells you a lot. The defense isn't raising the parents' knowledge to help Celeste. They're raising it to help Burke. Blair Burke's argument is straightforward. If the parents knew and consented, if they signed the forms and sent the singer along and attended church together, then maybe Burke believed the relationship was sanctioned. Maybe he didn't think he was doing anything wrong. That's the play. Muddy the water on intent. Create reasonable doubt. From a parenting standpoint, the defense's argument makes the parents look worse, not better, because Burke is essentially telling the court, these parents knew their daughter was spending time with my client. They facilitated it. They signed off on it. The defense also introduced text messages where Celeste threatened to destroy Burke's career and go to his mother. They argued she demanded the final meeting on April 23rd, that Burke initially said no because he was preparing for a trip, and that she pushed until he agreed. They even floated the idea that Celeste may have taken her own life, a claim the family's attorney called baseless and without evidentiary support, all of it designed to shift accountability away from the defendant. But if Burke's right about the parents, if the family truly did know and participate, then the parents enabled every hour Celeste spent at that house, every weekend, every trip, every overnight. The family's attorney, Steinfeld, told reporters the family was horrified that the defense brought up evidence to put the blame on a 14-year-old child. And he's right to be horrified by that. They also brought up blame to put on your clients, the parents. Celeste was a child. The defense pointed to texts where Celeste threatened to expose Burke and argued she demanded the final meeting. That's the kind of argument that falls apart the second you remember she was 14. She can't consent. She wasn't the adult in that situation. She was a kid. None of it was her fault, not one bit of it. But being horrified at the defense's tactics doesn't answer the question the defense raised. How much did the parents know, and what did they do about it? Burke goes to an arraignment on August 31st. The DA says the death penalty is on the table, and the evidence presented so far, according to prosecutors, only a fraction of what's coming at trial. Burke is the one charged. Burke is the one who allegedly took Celeste's life and left her remains in the trunk of his Tesla while he went on a world tour. The accountability for what happened in that Hollywood Hills house obviously belongs to him. But every adult in this girl's orbit failed her. The parents who signed the permission slip, the deputies who went to Burke's door in February 24, told him she was 13 and walked away satisfied. The management team that allegedly received an email from people concerned about Celeste's whereabouts and, according to reporting from Los Angeles Magazine, did nothing to intervene. The industry that handed this man Coachella stages, late-night television appearances, a world tour, and a record deal reportedly worth up to $19 million, while a 13-year-old's name sat in his phone records, not one of those adults put themselves between Celeste and what was coming. And they need to be held accountable. Celeste Rivas Hernandez was 14 years old. She never got to see 15. She deserved adults in her life who would protect her, who would see the permission slip and refuse to sign it, who would see the VIP section and ask questions, who would see the London itinerary and say no. She got adults who signed the form, and every one of them has to live with that. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversation right there. If you're not with us yet on the podcast platform, go check us out. That's the link right there. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, you name it. That link will take you to our podcast tree. Pick your player, press subscribe. You can take us along with you wherever you may go. All right. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on FinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey guys, Lady Luck here. Are you going on any road trips this summer? I know I'm going to be going on a bunch of road trips. And being that I'm going to be passenger princess, I love playing on SpinQuest.com. SpinQuest has all of my favorite slot games, live blackjack, live craps, head on over to SpinQuest right now and get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for $10. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.